This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Even as the world leaders gather for this year's World Economic Forum, deepening poverty and climate change are fueling inequalities in many parts of the world.
That's Ruben Chama reporting from the Kenyan capital. Details coming up. Also, thousands of Tunisians celebrated the 9th anniversary of the Tunisian Revolution. And with the excuse of cracking down on cybercrime, Tanzania's government plans to block all mobile phone SIM cards. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, several hundred demonstrators marched in Nairobi Friday to protest the mounting climate crisis and heightened poverty around the world. The march comes as leaders gather in Davos, Switzerland, for next week's annual World Economic Forum. From the Kenyan capital, Ruben Chama reports for VOA.
Carrying placards reading "Our Rights, No More, No Less," and "Budget for All, Not Just the Rich," the protesters marched from Nairobi's central Freedom Corner through the city center. The march is one of several planned worldwide to protest the annual gathering of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Jenny Ricks is the global convener for Fight Inequality Alliance, a coalition of international and national non-profit organizations and human rights campaigners.
Truly, truly a global protest. So we have our Pan-Africa coordinator, Joki Jehu, is going to Davos. She's joining with Greta Thunberg and the other school strike climate activists in a rally to demand an end to climate change and inequality. The message to the world leaders is that the people have the solutions to inequality, not the billionaires. The billionaire class needs to be abolished. Time is up for the billionaires.
The protest march in Kenya was among several protests taking place in 30 countries, including the United Kingdom, Zambia, India, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Mexico, and Uganda as part of the global protest to fight inequality. Antonia Musunga is the coordinator of Kenya Fight Inequality Alliance.
We're saying the people who are living their day-to-day lives affected by inequality have the solutions. And our leaders need to listen to those people and prioritize those people in decision-making, in political processes, in economic processes, in development initiatives so that we change the status quo, because it's time for us to have change.
In Kenya, the demonstrators delivered 10-point demand list to President Uhuru Kenyatta. Among its demands are allocating resources to protect the poor from the effects of climate change, ending harmful tax incentives, and addressing income inequalities. Even as the world leaders gather for this year's World Economic Forum, deepening poverty and climate change are fueling inequalities in many parts of the world. In Kenya, about 1 million school-aged children are out of school, and many women die of pregnancy-related complications or during childbirth due to lack of proper healthcare services. According to a recent study by the British charity Oxfam, about 2.6 million Kenyans fall into poverty or remain poor due to ill health each year. In the financial year 2018-2019, Kenya allocated less than a third of the budget to delivering services such as education, health, and water. Activist Louis Otieno says income inequality exacerbates human trafficking.
Many people have this perception that human trafficking happens only to victims who are going to the Gulf states, like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and these other areas just to face exploitation in terms of domestic work or domestic servitude. But also it's happening within our countries. So majorly in Kenya, you'll see that there are various three aspects, and people are facing different exploitation like forced labor, issues of child labor, issues of sexual exploitation.
The activists said the march is part of a landmark campaign against inequality. They say worldwide protests show that ordinary people best understand the crisis of inequality and, most importantly, have the solutions to end it. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Kenya has endured a grim start to the new year as the extremist group Al-Shabaab launched attacks against several targets, including a school, a police post, and a military base shared by U.S. forces. On Monday, three teachers were killed and one abducted in Kamuti, a town in Garissa County. VOA Salem Salomon spoke to Tresh Thomas, a security analyst focusing on Somalia, who says the group is able to exploit points of weaknesses along the Kenyan border.
Well, Somalia is still, obviously, the hub for Al-Shabaab activity, and they utilize the Boni Forest area to cross into Kenya and to attack soft targets like the U.S. base. I think Shabaab was able to identify this as a vulnerable spot that didn't have adequate force protection from U.S. and Kenyan forces. And so only with maybe 15 or so attackers actually on the base, they were able to destroy approximately $20 million in equipment, including spy aircraft that are used to collect intelligence on Al-Shabaab and to target mid-level and senior-level officials. So I think from that perspective, Al-Shabaab was able to achieve its objective. And I think that what needs to be identified is ways to actually stop Al-Shabaab from crossing the border, from recruiting inside Kenya. And that's something that Kenya hasn't been able to accomplish, even though it's been deployed in Somalia for the last 9 years.
Are the U.S. forces, you know, the military-to-military cooperation that Kenya has with the U.S., have they always been a target by Al-Shabaab, or is there some sort of increase in the attacks? Somebody mentioned to me that this is their season. If so, why is that?
There certainly have been significant attacks in January the last 4 or 5 years. If you look at the Dusit D2 hotel attack, you look at the attack in Kobio a couple years ago that killed at least 50 Kenyan forces, there tends to be chance of a major attack in January that Shabaab executes against Kenyan forces. In terms of cooperation between U.S. and Kenya, I think that this really does show a shortfall in the cooperation, in that you would think that with the resources that Kenya and the U.S. have, they would be able to secure a base, even though it's in a vulnerable location. But what I think this shows is that Al-Shabaab is identifying those shortfalls in force protection and is able to execute an attack without an adequate response from both U.S. and Kenyan forces. And that is very worrying in terms of how effective that partnership is being executed right now. So it's not looking very good right now, and there are several reasons for this. Number one, you still see Al-Shabaab have free mobility to cross the border from Somalia into Kenya. And that's because a lot of the areas don't have adequately manned checkpoints, and that one of the areas on the southeastern border in the Boni Forest is very rugged terrain that's hard for security forces to navigate and offers a safe haven to Shabaab. On the Somali side of the border, you still have security forces that are not integrated. You have tensions between the central government and regional administrations that prevent them from banding together to defeat Al-Shabaab. And then also you have the lack of a political solution in Somalia that, again, keeps the partners from having a security architecture that they can agree upon. So really you have all the ingredients to let Shabaab be resilient, to build its forces. You also see a lack of effectiveness from the U.S. drone strikes against Shabaab, and that's mostly because Shabaab has been able to rebuild its ranks very quickly and not rely on senior leaders. They have a very robust middle leadership that is able to continue plans very quickly when senior leaders die, and so that, again, enables Al-Shabaab's resiliency. So you also see them adapting new tactics, which includes the mass raid attacks that are very demoralizing to the regional forces that are in Somalia trying to deter that threat. So all the ingredients combined give Al-Shabaab a perfect scenario to outlast the African Union forces that are in Somalia right now. So until these forces band together and until the Somali partners band together, Shabaab will have all the ingredients that it requires to last for the long term.
That was Trey Thomas, a security analyst focusing on Somalia, speaking to VOA Salem Salomon. Thousands of Tunisians celebrated the anniversary of the Tunisian Revolution as the country marked 9 years since a democratic uprising ousted its longtime strongman, Zain El Abidine Ben Ali. The rally came amid deepening economic troubles in the North African nation and resurgent anger as the revolution's unfulfilled promises. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with Sarah Yerkes, fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, about achievements of the revolution and challenges facing the Tunisian transition to democracy.
The main achievements that Tunisia has achieved are in the political realm, where they've made tremendous political progress, including writing a new progressive constitution, holding a series of elections both at the national level and at the local level, and instituting really a vibrant and impressive civil society and media environment where people are able, for the first time, to question their government, to speak freely, to have the sort of freedom afforded in any democracy.
Does Tunisia still face security challenges as well?
There are security challenges, but one of the other successes over the past 9 years has been the maturity and the development of the security sector. The security forces have, with the assistance of a lot of the international community, United States, Germany, others, they've really improved the effectiveness of the security forces, particularly in dealing with the terror threat that remains. You have Libya on the one hand, where the situation is certainly not solved yet, and you have Algeria, where there are these different jihadi groups that hide out on the borderous mountain region with Algeria and Tunisia. So security remains a big challenge. However, it's one of the things that has made a lot of progress in the areas where Tunisia is really able to address that challenge effectively.
But while the Tunisian revolution is still considered the only success story in the Arab Spring, it faces some daunting challenges. Can you spotlight the most difficult ones?
The main challenges are in the economic sphere, where the issues that brought about the revolution in the first place really have not gone away. And specifically, that relates to unemployment, particularly youth unemployment, and very high levels of unemployment amongst those with a university degree, as well as corruption, the real system of corruption that we saw in place under Ben Ali that's been replaced by a sort of democratization of corruption, a really spreading of petty corruption, and the issues of dignity that, again, were the things that really sparked the revolution. Not a lot of progress has been made in those areas.
What about the efforts by counter-revolution and remnants of the deep state?
There certainly is a current of growing frustration amongst people, both people who see, again, that these economic challenges haven't been addressed, but also people who believe that democracy might not be the right answer for Tunisia. Now, this still is the minority of the population. Most Tunisians are willing to give democracy a chance, but you've seen the growth of this kind of counter-revolutionary movement, and that's really embodied by one of the members of parliament, Abir Moussi, who unsuccessfully ran for president. Her bloc won 17 seats in the parliament. That's a substantial block of seats, and it shows that there is this current of people who are really frustrated and maybe not willing to put up with democracy anymore.
So what do you make of the latest setbacks of failing to form a technocrat government and attempts to have a vote of no confidence in Parliament Speaker Rashid Ghannouchi?
I think the failure to form a government comes in large part because of the tremendously fractured nature of the parliament. This time around, Tunisia has no threshold for members of parliament. So anyone can get in. There's a lot of countries have higher thresholds, 3%, 5%. But in Tunisia, what this means is that you have a tremendous number of very fractured parties. So right now, there are 31 different party enlists in the parliament. So in order for someone to be able to achieve 109 seats, a majority, in order to be able to form a government, they need to get a lot of different disparate voices to agree, and that unfortunately didn't happen this time. This would have been the ninth government in 9 years, so this is really showing that, you know, you've had a lot of fracturing. But at the same time, I think what we've seen is that the party that was tasked with forming the government, Nahda, has been losing a lot of power and losing a lot of confidence of the people. They've steadily lost seats in each subsequent election, and I think we're starting to see frustration both amongst the people outside of the party but within the party itself that maybe Nahda is not really effective at governing right now.
That was Sarah Yerkes at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She was speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. You're listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. 20 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Demonstrators march in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, today to protest the mounting climate crisis and the heightened poverty around the world. And thousands of Tunisians celebrated the 9th anniversary of the Tunisian Revolution. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Tanzania's government plans to block all mobile phone SIM cards that are not registered biometrically by January 20th. Officials say the move is aimed at cracking down on cybercrime. But mobile phone users complain the deadline is too tight, and some of Tanzania's political opposition worry that blocking mobile communications could disrupt the general election scheduled for October. Charles Kombe reports from Dar es Salaam.
Large crowds of Tanzanians are lining up to register their mobile phone SIM cards before a January 20 deadline when authorities say all unregistered cards will be blocked. The registrations are needed, say authorities, to crack down on fast rising cybercrime, which jumped by 82% in Tanzania in 2017. Among the victims, Gift Swai, who was defrauded of $1,300 when she tried to purchase electronics online via her mobile phone. After sending the money, his number was never reachable, says Gift, adding that a biometric SIM card will help a lot. She said if the system was there when she lost the money, it would have been easier to catch him. The biometric registration will link SIM cards to identification cards or foreign passports and fingerprints. Tanzania's Communication Regulatory Authority says the registration will reduce cybercrime such as mobile payment fraud. Frederick Ntobi is the head of communications.
Simu hivi sasa ni benki. Hai kwa kati mizio rezo katuma hela kwenye...
Nowadays, phones are like banks, says Ntobi. Sometimes you might mistakenly send money to various places. Because the detail of the one who received the money will be known, he said it will be easier for your money to be returned. The strict cut-off deadline was imposed to force millions of Tanzanian mobile phone users who were slow or had missed the earlier deadlines to register. Tanzania's communication authorities say as of January 5, just over half of the country's 44 million SIM cards had been registered. But there is concern among Tanzanians that they may not be able to register in time and that their phones will be effectively cut off. Meanwhile, opposition lawmakers worry that cutting off unregistered mobile phones will be another hurdle to campaigning ahead of October elections.
Labda kwenye jimbo la Ubungo, kuna wapiga kura 20,000 au 40,000.
Chadema party leader Said Kubenea says if a member of parliament in the area wants to communicate with the public, ask for a vote or to share information, and 15,000 phones are turned off, 15,000 people will be out of the system. So Kubenea said the lawmakers will be unable to communicate with them. To avoid any such problems, Tanzanian authorities are urging everyone with a SIM card to register by the January 20 deadline. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam.
Authorities in Malawi say an invasion by fall armyworms is threatening to create food shortages in the southern African country. Since the start of the rainy season in November, the worms have destroyed crops for 250,000 farming families. Farmers say pesticides that the government is supplying are inadequate and ineffective, forcing some to turn to traditional methods to combat the pests. Lamek Masina reports from Mulanje District, Malawi.
26-year-old Malawian farmer Teresa Manuel is among the farmers most affected by an invasion of four armyworms. The mother of three normally harvests over 40 bags of maize from her 2-acre garden, but this season she is expecting almost nothing. She says, as for me, I have been adversely affected because my entire maize field has been attacked by the armyworms and I have nothing to rely on now. Armyworms, an invasive pest from the Americas that have devastated crops in Africa since 2016. They feed on cereal crops like maize, a staple food in Malawi. Malawi authorities estimate that since November, the worms have destroyed crops for over a quarter million farming families. Aida Deleza is a senior chief responsible for over 100 villages in her Chikumbu area.
That means another hunger now. We are going to face hunger in this area. There are a lot of villages which have been affected, as I have said, and it means hunger now. So we need government's intervention.
Malawi's Minister of Agriculture blames weather patterns for armyworm invasion. The ministry is distributing free pesticides to affected farmers, but are getting complaints that they are useless. Hilary Chinganda is an extension worker in the Ministry of Agriculture. She says the problem is that most farmers apply the pesticides when the worms are already grown. As a result, the worms don't die because they are old enough to resist the pesticides. Farmers like Manuel are resorting to homemade remedies to ward off the pest. She says as farmers, we are using our own traditional methods like applying soil, soup from small fish, leaves from the neem tree, and powdered soap. But Malawian farmers say they need more help to recover from the pest's damage. Aida John is among them. He says since the government appreciates that the invasion is huge, what we want is that it would consider providing us with the seeds, or they should give us food that will take us to the next growing season. Malawi authorities say they will soon distribute seeds to affected farmers. An armyworm invasion in 2017 forced Malawi to declare 20 of the country's 28 districts as disaster areas. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Mulanje, Malawi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.